And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
As we prepare for the Independence Day weekend, there's someone I want you to meet. His name is Nathan Law, a leader of the democracy movement in Hong Kong. And in his young life, he already has endured prison and is living in exile in London as China continues its brutal crackdown on freedom fighters in Hong Kong. We saw another turn of the wheel the other day when the government shut down Hong Kong's largest pro-democracy newspaper, jailing its publisher and several journalists. This happened after our conversation. So enjoy your weekend with family and friends. God knows how much we all have been looking forward to that. But I hope you also find time to listen to Nathan Law and reflect on the sacrifices he and his compatriots are making to win the freedom and democracy we Americans too often take for granted. Nathan Law, it's so good to see you. Welcome. Welcome to the Axe Files. Thank you for your time at the Institute of Politics.
No, thank you so much, David, for the invitation. It's been a meaningful quarter for me. This is the first time that I have a teaching role to instruct students about my activism and stories of Hong Kong. So I think that also means a lot to me.
Yeah, I suspect you've been doing a lot of teaching without even calling it teaching. But I appreciate what you're saying. Look, there's so much to talk about relative to Hong Kong, to China, and to the state of democracy in the world. But before we get to all of that, I want to put your own journey in context here. So let's start from the beginning. You were born not in Hong Kong, but in the People's Republic of China. Tell me about those early years. And tell me about your folks and what prompted them to move to Hong Kong.
Yeah, so my father was actually in Hong Kong when I was born in mainland China. He swam to Hong Kong in late 70s because there was pervasive famine in mainland China. His village didn't really have food for people to survive. So the only way for them to get life is to travel across the rivers that separate Hong Kong from China. And also that was a very turbulent trip. A lot of my father's generation, they didn't make it. They just died on the open sea. So he was the lucky guy that managed to go through that that journey. And by then there was a policy from the British government. It's called Touched Bay policy. Basically, if you arrive the city center, even though like you smuggled into Hong Kong, you could still get the citizenship. So my father did that, and he met my mother later. And when I was born in Hong Kong in 1993, when I was born in China in 1993, we reunion in Hong Kong in 1999 when I was six. So that was how I managed to come from mainland China to Hong Kong.
And your family, you know, I think there is sort of this casual image of Hong Kong as a very prosperous place. Yours was a very working class existence. Your family struggled to make ends meet. And so on. Talk a little bit about that, what life in your early life in Hong Kong was like.
I lived through my life in Hong Kong in public housing. My father was a constructor, was a builder. My mother was a cleaner. We are a typical working class family that there were some occasions we had to rely on government's funding subsidies to put food on table. So it hasn't been an affluent background for me. And most of the time when your parents are living through those conditions, they want you to be a provider. They want stability. That was how they teach me. Try to get a good job. Try to make provide for the family. But eventually, I did something that they could have never expected. I stepped into the arena of activism and eventually to politics. And they were very worried when they first learned that I was on protest sites. I was becoming a student leader. But that was the rest of the story.
Let's flesh it out just a little bit more. Your folks ultimately separated. So your mom really, in many ways, raised you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So my parents separated when I was in high school. So it was really tough for life like that. And but my mother raised like three of us together. So that was a remarkable achievement for her. And I'm truly grateful for that.
Politics was not something that was discussed around the house. Is that right? I mean, that was not a topic around the table.
Yeah. So when I was growing up, I would describe the way that my parents behave as having refugee mentality. So what they want is to have stability because they've been through extremely unstable time. And for them, they even though they know that there are problems in the society, they know that the government's ruling, the Chinese Communist Party, is bad because they had been through what a poor government looked like. But they still do not intend to get involved in social movement or in politics because they think that that is not for them, that is dangerous, that is dirty.
Yeah, they were afraid, isn't it fair to say?
Yes. I think part of the reason is they're afraid. They've been through a lot to come to Hong Kong and to try to live in a relatively stable situation. And they are afraid of their families, their children, getting persecuted by the government if they are speaking too loud. So that's the reason why we didn't really talk about politics.
So you were in a secondary school, what we would call a high school, and Liu Xiaobo was a Chinese author and dissident. He had participated in the Tiananmen Square protests, and he won the Nobel Prize. That was not celebrated at your school, was it?
My high school was a pro-Beijing one. It was operated by the pro-Beijing institution. I remember that I didn't really know much about Liu Xiaobo or about the advocacy work that he had committed in human rights or in freedom. But something happened really made me very curious about all of these things. So on the next day of Liu Xiaobo getting his Nobel Peace Prize, our school's principals on the morning assembly publicly criticized him. And by then I was curious because I learned that nominees of Nobel Prize are the people who have been excellent in that field. So how come such a person being criticized? So I looked up for what he had done, and that kind of opening up a gate for me to understand human rights situation in mainland China and all sorts of things. So that kind of like brainwashing education in an pro-Beijing school kind of backfired and make me more curious about the social affairs and what's happening around the world.
And you went on to university. Tell me how your activism unfolded at Lingnan University.
So when I entered the university, I was with a thought of getting involved in social movement because I consider myself half an intellect. And when I think that when we were talking about political reform in that year, in the year 2014, I realized that there is a need for students who has always been the spearhead of change in society to be involved. So I ran for the student union, and then eventually we became one of the leading organizations in the democratic movement.
Yeah. At that time, Beijing was promoting a law that would give it greater control over Hong Kong elections. This gave rise to the Umbrella Revolution of 2014. It went on for 79 days, mass civil disobedience. You mentioned your mom earlier. You were a leader of that movement. She did not know about your activism until she saw you on TV. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was actually an interesting story. I didn't tell my mom that I was involved in all these social affairs or student union or movement because I knew that she would be really worried. But eventually, the way that he recognized that I was involved was she was in a wedding boutique and she was chatting with her friends. They were happy. And by the time she looked up to the television, she saw the scene of her son being arrested by plainclothes police simultaneously. And she kind of shocked by what she saw. And she immediately find my friends, find my brothers to know what had happened on me. And that was the time she recognized that I am defaulting myself into the movement, into the cause. And Yeah, that was quite a remarkable story.
What was your discussion with her like when you finally got to talk about it?
It was already in the middle of the umbrella movement when I had a chance to really talk to her. By the time she met me, what she could say was just tell me, try to keep safe, try not to be intimidated or get injured when I was protesting. But of course, afterwards, she had told me that I should not be so high profile. I should not be involved in all these things. But by the time she recognized that, she's unable to change my devotion because I see it as my vocation. She slowly go to a more pacified position. Just try to tell me to keep safe, but not really like discouraging me from doing so.
When you got together with the other leaders of the umbrella movement, how much did you consider the potential risks of it? What kind of conversations did you have about that, about putting yourselves at risk, others at risk, and how Beijing might react to it?
Yeah, I think that is a really good question. For a lot of us, when we first discussed about being involved in politics, political movement, protesting on the streets, of course, we had certain expectation on what's coming to us. But most of the time, those are not the precise prediction. And for example, at the beginning when we were protesting, we didn't realize that at the end of the day, that Hong Kong will become the shape that it is now, like having a national security law, people's freedom of speech are being restricted. And when you first go to protest, of course, for me, I had preparation of being arrested, being charged, being jailed, and that was what I had been through. I served jail time for more than 2 months. It is not a long length of sentencing compared to the ones now. By the time, like we were in 2014, we expect months of imprisonment, but for now it's years, even though you do the same thing. So it's always difficult to predict what persecutions that are laying ahead of you. What you can do is you just have to adjust yourself step by step. And by the time that you recognize you are bearing the consequence and the persecution of the government, the only thing that you could do is to try to keep your mind calm and treat it normal mind. Otherwise, it's unbearable.
Yeah, what was that experience like? As you point out, you were in just for several months, and I shouldn't say just, but you were in for a few months in prison. We should point out, you're still young. Okay, you're still quite young, but you were 21 years old when this was happening. How did you occupy yourself in prison? How were you treated? And how, if at all, did it change you?
Yeah, so in 2014, the umbrella movement ended. And in 2017, when I served the legislature for more than 9 months, I was unseated. And then a month later, after the disqualification, in 2017, August, I was jailed because of my participation in the 2014 umbrella movement. So it took 3 years for the government to put me in jail.
Well, let me interrupt, Nathan, because I jumped ahead in the storytelling. And so let's go back. And because there is a relationship, I suspect, between the fact that you got elected to the legislature there and the fact that these charges were brought after you got elected and, as you say, disqualified. But let's go. There were a couple of middle steps. You ran for and were elected General Secretary of the Hong Kong Federation of Students, and that was a platform for you, and that elevated your status even more. And then with Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow, you started Democisto, a party,
Yes.
in a political party committed to democracy in Hong Kong. And so now you're 23 and you ran for the Legislative Council of Hong Kong and you won. First of all, were you surprised that you had won? And how surprised do you think the authorities were that you won?
Well, the victory of my election was an underdog story. So at first, when I found Democisto with Joshua and Agnes, we wanted to inject the youth energy into the political scene because a lot of Hong Kong people criticized the traditional parties of becoming aging and not reflecting what young protesters thinking in the ordinary political setting. So by then we found a party together, and we have incredible young members. I think in average, the age of the members were actually younger than I by the time I was 23. So we consolidated a lot of activists, but also some academia into our group. And after that, when I decided to run for the election, it was the election took place in September 2016. And a month before that, the first poll data came out. I was only having 1% of supporting rate. So we were running in, I was running in a constituency that had the highest education, the most wealthy one, most aged one. And people consider legislators from that constituencies as professionals. Those winners of the district, they were all lawyers, ex-government officials, respected academia, etc. So when I was running for six seats, because it was proportional election, a month before, I was unpopular. I guess people just felt like I was still an undergrad student. I was a protest leader, but didn't know that I had the capacity to talk about policies or have the experience or relative knowledge on bringing something that can be realized and meaningful to the to the society. But during that time, I campaigned really hard. And I think what overturned people's expectation and their thoughts about me were my performance in the election forums, which in our tradition, we had a couple of the public forums organized by TV stations. And in that forum, I demonstrate a way of talking about policy, reasoning, and people felt like, he was not someone that I imagined. I guess those perceptions were overturned, and subsequently supports consolidated, and I won the election by having the second highest vote in 15 lists.
But what was that like for you when that happened? I mean, it must have been a hopeful moment.
Yeah, it was quite unbelievable, actually, to have a sweep like that. And I think it really shows that Hong Kong people want fresh faces, and they want people, not only they can lead protesters, but they can also really talk about concrete policies and having a strong way of understanding of the society. So I guess that was really an empowering moment for all of us.
That was an empowering moment. And then what was it, a month later that you were, a month into your tenure or something, you were disqualified? And incredibly, I think I've got this right, you were disqualified for quoting Gandhi at your swearing in, a quote of his, you probably still remember it, that was viewed as provocative.
Yes. So a month after the election victory, we had to sworn in, and we had a tradition of adding phrases before and after the whole oath in order to demonstrate our political belief. I had consulted with a legal opinion, and I decided to add in quotes from Gandhi and words to say that I am there to represent the people, to serve the people, instead of a regime that brutally kills its people. So I made that very clear. And after the swearing-in ceremony, the Chinese government didn't like the way that we take our oath, and they decided to implement political persecution on us. The way that they do is they reinterpret our constitution, which in advanced countries, the rights of reinterpreting the constitution, of defining the constitution, lies on the courts, whether it is Supreme Court or Constitutional Court. But in our system, the right lies on the hands of the National People's Congress Standing Committee, which those are the people who only think about things in political in political aspects, and they make decision to benefit the Chinese Communist Party instead of following the rule of law. So they made a reinterpretation in order to add new requirements into the oath-taking ceremony and considering those people who have said something before and after the oath-taking ceremony as illegitimate when they interpret those things as insincere or not paying allegiance to the country. So I was seen as not paying the allegiance to the country in a very narrowly defined way. And after 9 months that I served the council, I was evicted. More than 50,000 ballots from the voters are tossed into the trash can.
The country to which you were being viewed as disloyal, in reality, was the People's Republic of China. And you were viewed as dangerous on that legislative council, I think it's fair to say.
I think the Chinese government just felt the heat. They didn't want so many legislators in the council that severely challenge them and bring issues that make them uncomfortable. For example, issues of democracy, issue of the rights of people to design its future. So that's why they had another round of political suppression by disqualifying legislators.
The news of your election was basically blacked out on the across China. And I'm sure that part of their concern was that democratic people who have democratic aspirations in China might take inspiration or heart from your story. So you were an inconvenient story for them, and your movement was an inconvenient movement.
Well, definitely. The Chinese government has always been afraid of the spillover effect, which the movement in Hong Kong affects any parts of the people or the regions in mainland China. So they have had a huge internet firewall to block out all these informations and promote their own narrative, which stigmatizes all the democratic fighters and movement in Hong Kong.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. How long after you were removed from the council were you arrested?
So 1 month after I was unseated, I got a verdict on court, and I had to go to jail because of that. Just in a month, I was kind of like degraded from quote-unquote an honorable legislator to inmate. That was actually a huge blow for me. I had a period of time that I had to adjust myself and just felt depressed because of that.
You quoted Gandhi. That's what allegedly got you into hot water. But, you know, Gandhi has been an example to freedom fighters and fighters for democracy for generations. Dr. King being an example of that. Did you study them? Were they examples to you?
Well, yes, definitely. I think the stories of these great people are the things that supported my mental health, actually, when I was in jail. And when I was in jail, I read a lot of autobiography of these great civil rights leaders, democratic fighters, because I want to learn how they can manage to go through all these much more torturing experience. Like Gandhi, he's been in jail for decades. Dr. King, he's been arrested for more than 30, 40 times. There were a lot of sufferings, but they managed to uphold their belief at the end of the day. So what triggered them? I think that was the answer that I want to have, because compared to them, what I had suffered was minimal, but I had already felt difficulties of going through those experiences. So I think it's important that I learn from them.
We talked earlier about your mother. How did your family process all of this? From you talk about this incredible fall from being the honorable to being the inmate. Were you able to see your family? Did you communicate with them? And how did it impact on them? And did they feel pressures?
Yeah, when I was in jail, I could see my families once a week for 30 minutes. I remember whenever my mother visited me, she pretends to be happy. She pretends to be like glad to see it. It's easy to see through her disguise, because we have been living together for decades. And I learned that from my friends, from her friends, that she was so troubled by the fact that I was in prison. When she was doing cleaning duty for people's home, she cut herself with a really deep wound. And I learned that from a friend of mine, and she didn't tell me when she visited me. I just felt like it's difficult to balance everything. At first, I didn't know that it impacted her so much. And I realized that it's difficult to balance your duties in family and your duties in society when the society became so bad. And if you want to carry or shoulder the responsibility as an activist to go against injustice, then you must sacrifice the responsibility in family.
Knowing everything you know now, would you have done things differently, anything differently?
Well, I always feel like seeing things in a retrospective angle is difficult because for now I have much more knowledge than the one that I made decision. But in a hindsight, no, I think everything I did was for my belief. I did without any consideration of personal interest, and that was all that I could do. I devoted all of myself and my very best to the struggle of Hong Kong. Even though I end up losing my seat, being imprisoned now in exile, never going to visit my family in Hong Kong as long as the Chinese Communist Party is there. Even though it ended up like this, I still feel like I have done my part and I'm proud of it.
I want to get to where we are at this moment. You came to the U.S., you went to Yale to pursue a master's degree in Asian studies. You testified before Congress on behalf of a piece of legislation to try and pressure China to live up to the agreement it made with Britain for a one country, two systems approach when Britain handed over Hong Kong. And then you returned to Hong Kong and you were planning to run again, weren't you, for the Legislative Council?
Yeah, in March 2020, when I finished my studies in the US and I came back to Hong Kong, I decided to run alongside with Joshua and other protest leaders for the election, because there was supposedly an election in 2020. So that was my purpose of going back to Hong Kong. I want to continue to serve the people, even though the council is so rigged and the election is so rigged. But we want to challenge that.
And in the midst of this, Beijing promoted an even tougher new security law with 66 articles that basically savaged dissent, freedom of expression, a lot of the things that you were fighting for. And with that law in place, they began arresting your friends, your colleagues, your allies. You went into hiding. You feared for your safety. Talk about that period.
2 months before the implementation of the national security law, we heard about the government was going to propose a law like that. We didn't know about the details at the beginning. But when the time goes, in early or in mid-June, we finally knew that it was such a draconian law that our freedom of speech will be curtailed severely. So at the end of June, I had to think about what is my next move, because I believe that it's important that we preserve a voice that could speak up for Hong Kong and to continue the international advocacy work free from the threat of the national security law. So that was the main reason why I flee Hong Kong to London just before it was implemented.
How did you get out, given the fact that you guys were being hunted? How did you get out of Hong Kong? Did you have difficulty getting out?
Well, when I was trying to leave Hong Kong, I had worries that whether my name was blacklisted, whether they would block me from leaving in the airport. But eventually, it didn't happen. And I was lucky because my passport was not confiscated. I was not arrested by the time because of protest-related cases. So that's why I could manage to leave. And probably because for the past year, for most of the past year, I I was studying in the US, so I kind of like get out of the radar because of that. But eventually, when I left, we could really see the impact of the national security law immediately after it was implemented. Up until now, it's almost a year, and the police had made more than 100 arrests under the national security law. Some of the cases were just because the arrestees chanted certain slogans, sang certain songs, displayed certain lead flags or flags that has certain political belief. And another landmark case for the primary election, 47 Democratic campaigners arrested because they were hosting a primary election for their own camp, and they were arrested under the national security law. So by just observing those cases, you could really see that those vaguely defined national security law is used to become a legal weapon to prosecute democratic activists.
When you left, Nathan, when that plane was taking off, did you think to yourself, I may never come back? I may never be able to see my family again. I may never be able to see my friends and allies again. I mean, that must have been an extraordinarily emotional time.
Yeah, it was extremely emotional. I remember that the exact day when I finished dinner with my family, I had a backpack and I had a hand carry suitcase with me, and I departed to the airport. I couldn't talk to them. I couldn't explain my decision because I was afraid that by the fact they knew that I was leaving, they would be submitted to government's prosecution. They would be arrested because they were colluding with me in government's term. So I didn't have any opportunity to explain to them, to tell them how much I love them and to say a proper goodbye. And when I arrived at the airport, I was so nervous. And when I successfully boarded the plane and it was taxiing and it flew to the sky, and I was sitting by the window and I looked back to Hong Kong. As we all know, Hong Kong has fantastic night view.
Yes.
It was like the most gorgeous night cityscape that I think that you have seen in the world. And I was watching it and enjoy it. And I was thinking that could probably be the last time that I could watch the city that I've been fighting for past years, that I served it, that I jailed for it, that was jailed for it. That was probably the last time I saw this fantastic night view. So that was really emotional. And by the time I realized that I had to embark a journey that I don't really have knowledge about.
As you said, you're working this from the outside now. There are your friends and colleagues on the ground there. First of all, your party's dissolved because it couldn't exist under the law as it was written. And you've had friends who, if you said, gone to prison for years and not months. Any sense of guilt about being on the outside and free? It sounds like, in a sense, you're in a prison of your own because you're separated from the people you love and care about. But do you feel in any way that you got the better half of the deal?
That is always a sense of a survival guilt for me. It is not because I think that I have done anything wrong, but it's because that when I see my fellows who share the same pursuit, same worries, share the same beliefs as I, but they have sacrificed a lot more than I. By the fact that they are in jail and I'm not, it's already a torturing idea for me to continue to live like that. But on the other hand, it's just part of the emotion. I see it as a process of how to transform these rather negative emotion into a positive one, because I know that grieving myself doesn't help. But actively engaging into the political discussion to promote your stories and Hong Kong stories and to urge the world to adopt a more assertive approach to China. These are the things that help. And it takes agency, it takes empowerment, it takes a lot of energy to do so. So I create a term for that. I describe it as fertilization, which you kind of bury your negative emotion and let the time goes, and then it becomes something that helps you to nurture better ideas, nurture new life, transforming something bad, bad emotion into positive energy and momentum. I think this is just the lesson that every exile activist or anyone in the diaspora community have to go through.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. How is life for you in London, and how much do you feel hunted by China? Because you are leading now, you're leading a global movement or trying to ignite one that can't be welcome there. How much do you fear for yourself there? What's your life like? And I guess the other question is, like, how do you support yourself?
It's a really good question. So my asylum application was granted in April. But before that, I had moved for 4 times because I was worried about my personal safety. I had been refraining myself from going out or attending public events because I was worried about Chinese agents or espionage activities. We all understand that how extensive these authoritarians' reach could be. And for me, being situated in a position that actually had never taken place, there have not been a prominent Hong Kong activist being in exile and also committing himself fully into the international advocacy work in the history. So that was a new role, and I don't know how the Chinese Communist Party would react to it. So I act very discreetly. But after I got the asylum status, I had more confidence in my personal safeties because I finally have a legal status in the UK, and I became more active in terms of interacting with people and outreaching to community. So that I think it's just a path, it's a trajectory that I have to go through.
Mm-hmm. And how do you support yourself? I mentioned you were a fellow at my institute, Politics at the University of Chicago, remotely. You're writing a book, I know, but how do you get along?
I write. I have a subscription service for my political commentators, and I also write op-eds to newspapers. So I think it's important that we have to support ourselves, and also we have to continue to deliver new thoughts and new understandings of the world to the people in Hong Kong and to the people around the world. A large part of my work focuses on how to digest Hong Kong situation and translate it into a format that external audience are more easy to digest. And also digesting the global development of political dynamics into a perspective that that Hong Kong people could see how do these changes impact Hong Kong and impact China. So this is something that I am doing, and I think providing this knowledge and invigorating understanding and discussion on it is also important.
You had a close-up view of how the world leadership is thinking about China because the Group of Seven was just in your neck of the woods there in London or near London to talk about their agenda. United States President Biden pushed hard for language that was harder on China than we've seen in the past, but still met with some resistance. And I'm wondering if you were satisfied with the language, and do you think enough is being done to pressure China on Hong Kong, on Taiwan, on the treatment of the Uyghurs and human rights generally? Do you think enough was done?
Well, I think the way of rebuilding the transatlantic relationship is definitely a good sign on how we can consolidate efforts mm-hmm. on tackling the rise of authoritarian expansion of China. And I think only by having coordinated actions from around the world, we could successfully curb their aggression and also hold them accountable. So I think for now, we're heading into the right direction. And in the G7 summit's statement, Hong Kong was mentioned, Taiwan was mentioned, Xinjiang was mentioned. These three issues are undoubtedly the most heated topics of human rights violation in mainland China. And I think we just have to continue to put attention to it. But eventually, what I really want, what I really hope is these leaders to treat the global democratic recession as a genuine crisis. They've been trying to deal in it with individual capacity, individual issues. But if we are lacking coordination and a clear objective and goals of it, it's easy for the authoritarian countries like China to crack our collaboration and try divide and conquer tactics in our alliance. If we are still complacent towards the expansion of these authoritarian regimes, we will lose golden opportunity to curb that. I believe that we just have to see the global democratic recession as a crisis, as the way we treat climate emergency, as the way we treat poverty, that we will have certain global goals. We have institutions and bodies that helps to craft all the policy we need, and we have to implement it coordinatedly. So I think this is definitely the only way forward to stop Taiwanese from coming out again and to stop people from being suppressed in those regions.
So China responded to the G7 communique by scrambling fighter jets over in Taiwanese airspace. And that was widely viewed as their message, which is we are not going to allow you to interfere in what we consider internal issues and issues of strategic importance to us. What do you think it would take? And, you know, certainly President Biden, one of his fundamental messages was the one you are sharing here, which is there is a struggle going on between democracy and authoritarianism, and only by working together can the democracies of the world prevail. But what specific actions do you think would actually get the attention of China in a way that would cause it to change its policies?
I think China has always been confident, at least for the past 5 years, in terms of their development and the trajectory and the way that they despise the so-called Western values or the universal values, make them so aggressive towards all these allegations and all these concerns over its human rights violation. This is definitely the way that they would act. No matter they are feeling the heat or they're just too confident, they are always going to tell the audience in mainland China that they are not going to listen to the Western. They're going to go for their own path. But I believe that it doesn't mean that they don't feel the heat or they are not pressured because of the coordinated actions. In China, there are lots of internal external problems they're experiencing. They're in an aging society. They are having struggle on industrial transformation. There are social unrest because I'm very pressured a working environment and society culture. There are problems in rural and conflicts in rural and developed areas. They are also a regime that they have to tackle a lot of problems because all of their legitimacy are resulted by nationalism and economic growth. And whenever there is a massive slow in their economic growth, they need to resort to other paths to gain legitimacy. And that's why the increasingly extreme nationalism emerged. But it has a cost. The cost is international isolation and also less reliance of the other countries on China's production because of political pressure. And it becomes a vicious cycle. Its economy will only go worse. when its extreme nationalism cultivates. And by the time there will be voice of resorting legitimacy from other pathway, it could be people's participation, it could be something else. We don't know yet. But by looking at China's situation in that lens, the only thing that the international community should do is to be in solidarity. We have to continue to decrease our reliance on China. We have to continue to put more scrutiny on their state enterprise into our countries and their infiltration, the expansion of soft power and soft power, and also decrease any formal recognition to their regime. For example, stop diplomatic delegation of major events when they're hosting. I think these things could definitely contribute to a lot more doubts of their people to the regime. Well, that's the way that we could trigger more concerns from its people to its regime and resort other pathway to legitimize it.
You mentioned a couple of the barriers. One is China using its soft power. They've been very aggressive, their Belt and Road Initiative and so on, in creating economic ties to countries around the world. And they are a huge source of supply chains around the world. You're saying that this has to change, and that's difficult. These take time. They take investment. And, you know, China's argument is that the authoritarian model actually works better because it is agile. It isn't, democracy is a lumbering process, sometimes doesn't move fast enough, doesn't make the investments that are necessary, and so on. There are tangible steps that the allies have to take to actually produce the effects that you're talking about.
Yes, definitely. But I think the perception has been changing. There have been too much economic blackmailing, bullying from mainland China that forced the countries to rethink their reliance on it. Norway, they were punished after they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to Liu Xiaobo. Australia, they're punished because they appeal for a thorough investigation on the origin of the COVID pandemic in Wuhan. Canada, they were punished because they had arrested Ma Mangzhou, one of the leaders of the of Huawei,
right.
and a Chinese enterprise that closely related to the Chinese army. There are so many examples of that, and I think a lot of countries are just recognizing that if they are relying on a region, that all of its economic power can be politically weaponized. There is a huge fragility of it.
We talked a little bit earlier about Taiwan. What is your level of concern that Taiwan could be, that the crackdown in Hong Kong is a predicate to more and more aggressive action relative to Taiwan?
In the beginning of the one country, two system, Deng Xiaoping says that it was actually setting an example for Taiwan, because when there is a so-called peaceful reunification, Taiwan will also adopt the one country, two system of Hong Kong. But throughout the years, when we saw the protest movement in Hong Kong in 2019, we immediately realized that one country, two system is not working for Taiwan. And in their presidential election, Taiwan won with a large margin, and it was seen as Taiwanese people saying no to Chinese influence and basically saying that it's impossible for us to conduct any quote-unquote reunification with you. So the last resort of the Chinese Communist Party would definitely go for military route. And there is an eagerness of doing so, because Xi Jinping, the rejuvenation of the nations, this project is heavily relying on the narrative of a reunification. And for Taiwanese people, they would see it as an annexation. And so we have come up to this point that there is an intention from the Chinese Communist Party that they wanted Taiwan. But in Taiwan, and luckily, unfortunately, the allies of Korea, Japan, and U.S. under the U.S. leadership says really loud that military intimidation to Taiwan is not acceptable. So I think the argument will continue. China will continue to harass Taiwan in whatever ways that they can. And to prove that Xi Jinping still wants to have a military conquer on Taiwan.
You spent time here in the United States, and obviously the United States is a pivotal player in all of what you're talking about in terms of strengthening democracies, pushing back on autocracy. How closely did you monitor this last election in America, the politics of the last 4 years, and particularly the events of January 6th in the United States, the insurrection at the Capitol? And what were your thoughts when you saw that?
Yes, I've been following it quite closely. Definitely, I'm not an expert on it, but the political development of U.S. indeed shows certain worries about democracy, especially under the age of social media, the echo chamber, the tribalized way of understanding reality, or even an annihilation of objective reality, loss of truth. These are worrying signs for democracy, because in democracy we need to have deliberation, we need to have discussion. But what if all parts of the world have different understanding of the facts and truth? There will be no meaningful discussion. So I think this is something that we definitely have to work on. But I also see strength in democratic system, especially after the January insurrection. Even though we've got such a disturbance into our legitimate democratic process, but we can see a rebound of the society that the transition was, at the end of the day, relatively peaceful. It's difficult to say that it was smooth, because there were so many incidents happening. But eventually, they made it. And even though in this divisive politics, in this very turbulent times, they still managed to have a transfer of power, which is a testing stone of whether a system is democratic or not. And after the insurrection, there has been a lot of discussion, a lot of investigation. And I just feel like sometimes there are a lot of, in a society that champion free speech, we will listen to a lot of criticism, perspective, and opinion. But at the end of the day, the fact that we can listen to so diverse narrative and opinion from people is already a blessing. If the same thing happens in mainland China, they only have one media tone, they only have one set of narrative. If there are divergence, they will all be immediately banned or screened out from public sites. So I just feel like, for me, I think there is no perfect democratic system. As David, you said, democracy is a project. It's an ongoing process. It's a process that we have to continue to refine it, and new challenges emerging every day. And that's the reason why I think protest is crucial for democratic society, because protest is acting like a preemptive warning to the society. When things go wrong, people come out to protest, and the government, if the government listens to it, then it could enhance its political system. That was a lesson learned also for me to watch through the development of the U.S. politics for the past year.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, we in America are about to mark Independence Day, and I hope that people listen to this podcast and understand that democracy is, in fact, a project that people all over the world are sacrificing for what we have, and that it is worth fighting for and not taking for granted. And certainly your life, your young life, not even 30, is already a testament to that. And I look forward to seeing what you do in the future. And you have a new book coming out, I think, in the fall that we'll all be reading with interest. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your sacrifice. Thank you for being here, and thank you for inspiring these young people at the Institute of Politics.
No, thank you so much, David. It's my honor to be able to talk to you in this podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files. brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.